Hi, how are you? I have misplaced a few things. Among them, my copy of Pedagogy of the Oppressed. Every episode since starting to read that book on this podcast, I have referenced, yes, I will finish it. I will finish it. I swear the next episode, I'll see you next week and I will finish it. Here's the thing, like I did finish it in my personal life, but I don't feel the need to continue reading it on here. And maybe that will change. But I also have misplaced this book. But I have not misplaced what it means to me philosophically. And there are a few books like this, and there are many books that I read and reread all the time. There are many books that like I don't even read as words on the page. I listen to them and I listen to them over and over, and I feel that like listening to them so often makes them a part of like my chemical makeup somehow. And so there's something about Pedagogy of the Oppressed that, like, I don't have to read it to know that I live it all the time. And I have only come to this realization that I have misplaced this book because I looked for it today. Today was a very odd day. I woke up to, I don't really participate in the news. I probably should, and I really like my life the way it is without it. But sometimes the news will find you. It's almost like the news knows that you're not interested, and so it will throw at you like the most disgusting thing that it can possibly think of to ruin your morning or your lunch or your whatever part of the day that you're finding it. And I actually like left social media because of that, and I don't miss it at all. But there are some forms of media that you just can't like avoid. Like you need certain parts, certain pieces of media, and like even those things can betray you and show you this like horrible information. So the horrible information that I came across today that like put me on this like search was this information about truckers, cross-country truckers, I guess. I don't even want to say it. There was a news story about cross-country truckers that felt devastating to me. And it felt devastating to me because New York was being targeted. And targeting New York just feels like reminiscent, of a time that I was never part of, but a time that I know a lot about. And I think the person at the center of this trucker's news story was not too different from, the president who says to New York, go to hell. That's like a 70s newspaper headline. I'm sure it was the Post. I'm also sure it was not the Post, but it seems like something that the Post would publish. I should get my facts. Hold on. Wait, I'm sorry about that sound quality in that first part. The Apple headphones are not what they're cracked up to be, at least like not long term. The other day I found myself wearing like wired headphones, and I felt for the first time like this is like the most reasonable thing that I've done in a long time is to wear wired headphones. And I don't know when we started calling it wired headphones, but Spotify, shout outs to Spotify, called it that when I was like, looking for something within Spotify, instead of saying like
blah, blah, AirPods connected. It was like wired connection. I've had a lot of moments like that recently too. Like, oh, like that's what we're calling this like thing that used to be totally normal and we would just call headphones or we would just call MetroCard. Like, that's what we're calling this now. Wow. I can't wait. I can't wait for all of this like technology to come crashing down and we have to like have a dial-up connection again. And what are they gonna call it? They're gonna call it a manual, I don't know. What are they gonna call it? Where you have to like plug in the internet, to your computer from the wall. Because I don't think we're gonna go that far back. I don't think it's gonna like be the 60s, but I think it'll like go back about 30 years, which is only like, what is that? 1995. Okay, I'm rambling. The fact that I was checking was a headline about a president kind of like targeting New York in bad choices that they were making. And the headline, the New York Post headline actually, was not the one that I was remembering, but it says, Ford, let the city go broke. And then the Daily News headline, this is all from 1975, is the one that I thought I was remembering. Ford to city, drop dead. Vows he'll veto any bailouts. And then the New York Times headline that same day. This is October 29, 1975. The point is, he's kind of like, this president is denying any federal bailout to a suffering city. And there was something about this like news piece that found me today that felt like really reminiscent of that. As much as like I wasn't even alive for that in 1975, the more you know, the more you worry. And so I just find the news system right now and like the social media systems right now and like the concept of like the algorithm and like the worst concept of AI, like I find all of it very suspicious. Like, why are you feeding me this news story when I'm doing nothing to tell you that I want the news? I just think all of it is corporate interest. Like, which corporations have I like, not encountered, but entertained even with my attention? Because that's what these phones are doing. That's what all of this technology is doing. And that's why I think it will go back about 30 years when it does all come crashing down. Because like it's surveilling us in such a way that it's like a couple of phones ago, it was still an iPhone, but a couple of phones ago, I think I like started to get really like aware of it because there would be a red light blinking as this thing was like surveilling me. And like, I think I called Apple for a different reason. And I meant like, we fixed the other problem that I was calling about. They were super helpful. We love to call Apple. We love to be helped. Shout outs to the Apple store on Madison Avenue. I go to that one all the time. I like to repair my geriatric computer, even though I've got plenty of other technology I could be using. I digress. But yeah, I noticed this like flashing red light in 2020 on my phone that wouldn't stop flashing. And I mentioned it as I was being helped with something else. And they said to me, like, that's how you know it's working. I come from a time where a flashing red light means recording. So, right. I'm not on to like a conspiracy theory right now or anything of that nature. I'm just saying, right? Like, I noticed this flashing red light and they tried to tell me, yeah, that's how you know it's working. What is it? This thing has like five front-facing cameras. You mean to tell me that it's not watching me? Go to hell. Also, nobody said New York go to hell. I made that up. Trying to remember this like Ford headline. Okay. So how do we get here? We got here because I was looking for my copy of Pedagogy of the Oppressed, and I can't find it. And I think everything happens for a reason, because in searching for it, I did find something else that I think is a lot more interesting than reading chapters 3 and 4 of Pedagogy of the Oppressed. Like books like that, you live them, you are them, and you teach other people to be that. It's not about like, oh, here's chapter 3 and these are the spark notes. Yo, shout out to spark notes, whatever happened to them? Spark notes, pink monkey. It's not like, well, I don't know, right? Like maybe these things are still around, but you never hear about them anymore because everything just can like be Googled. And that's the end of that. Like even the way that people are getting their information is not even that interesting. Like make me have to go to the library again. There's a sense of like everything is too convenient. Like these truckers. Okay, I digress. So, as I was looking for my copy of Pedagogy of the Oppressed, as I was coming to this realization, like this happened for a reason. Like, I don't need to read out loud this book again. What I need to do is think critically about like what this book has meant to me. So, actually related to this like story about the truckers that like I'm not saying the whole story about, what I did find was a reflection for a course that I was taking, all the way back during a different presidency, a Republican presidency. I think I'm just like he who must not be naming this person, and I'm okay with that, for now, right? Because the inevitable is inevitable after all. We'll deal with that when we get there. But what struck me about finding this was that the date on it is nearly 10 years ago, which the date on it being nearly 10 years ago is difficult for my mind to process, because like everybody's got like quick mental math about like, oh, if it's this year, then this year was like 5 years ago. For example, you know, you say to somebody, it's 2024. And so someone with like clearer math than me says, oh, 4 years ago, I was X age and that was 2020 and we were in the pandemic, right? Like it's all about like frames of reference using the numeracy, right? Like numeracy is like skills with numbers, using the numeracy of the year. But I think not everybody's perfect and everybody's got their own like thoughts on like the year and like what that year means. So I live in a world where like if I read the date somewhere, I don't think of like compared to right now. I think of compared to the year that my brain thinks it is. And I think my brain thinks it's 2020 because I read this date and I was like, oh, that's just 5 years ago. But it's actually nearly 10. And so I was really struck by like the date. I read the date last, even though it's like the first thing on this page. I was struck by the date because it's quite a long time ago, and what I'm about to read, this reflection, still rings so true, and it actually speaks to an experience that I had about a week ago. So let's get into it. But wait, did you drink something? You're gonna need to like lubricate your senses for this one. I'm doing so with spring water from Italy. We love the spring water. I'm also like very dubious of like what's going on with our water in America. I mean, like, did everyone forget about these, like, devastating train crashes right by bodies of water? Because I didn't. Oh, and you know what else I thought about? Like, we put the salt on the snow, and it helps the snow melt, and then, like, the water evaporates back up, and you hope that it's pure water, but if science teaches us nothing, it's that, like, matter is constantly breaking the rules. So how do we know that, like, the salt is not, like, at least in trace amounts going back up into the clouds? And that's why when it rains, like, if I get touched by the rain, I am like, my skin is irritated for days at a time. You know, it's not, like, entirely science fiction that climate agencies, I don't want to call it, like, the government or, like, whatever, climate agencies can fashion rain. It's not that difficult. They put ice crystals into the clouds, and that causes them, like any solution, right? Clouds are a solution, like any solution, to crash out, to quite literally precipitate, because, you know, something has disturbed the balance of the solution that is the cloud being both gas and liquid, water at the same time. You know, you introduce a new variable, suddenly there's, like, a solid. Now the equilibrium is thrown off. What happens? Some of that liquid pours down as rain. But, like, the rain doesn't even rain anymore. Like, yeah, like, it rains, water comes out the sky, but there was a way that Mother Nature felt, right? And, like, I haven't felt that in a long time. Okay, that aside, let's start to read this reflection. Again, it's about 10 years old, and there's so much of it that rings true. And then I'll tell you about last week. Educational philosophies are deeply personal systems of thought, which teachers apply to their students in classrooms. However, we as teachers do not always realize that our philosophies have to address more than just our classroom management and how we teach our content. Amid state testing pressures, curriculum planning, paper grading, and the other challenges of teaching, teachers must remember that their students in their classes are primarily developing children. Developing children have needs different from that of the gender-neutral and seemingly anonymous, quote-unquote, students, and must be treated as such. This Week in Social Foundations, I guess that was the name of this class, Social Foundations. This Week in Social Foundations, I recognized, I have a typo here. I recognized a few new philosophical outlooks that will leave room for my students to be people who are in the richest part of their development of social skills, character, and logical reasoning. The core of most educational philosophies are ways in which to get people more aware of how they live their lives. These philosophies serve to give teachers an overarching motivation for their classroom, since learning is certainly the focus of school, but so is living, or learning how to live one's life effectively. Vandenberg shares his thoughts on phenomenology and existentialism as guiding the way in which teachers allow their students to experience themselves as well as experience learning. Phenomenology is the way in which, quote, the child expands his reality through personally significant learning that promotes a fuller presence to the world. End quote. Put simply, phenomenology is the way in which we experience the world, and more importantly, the way students experience learning in class with you, their teacher. It is important for teachers to become aware of power structures within their classroom, as this is a part of phenomenology many people may overlook. For example, if a teacher is always the one to evaluate correct and incorrect answers, they are empowering themselves while disempowering students from recognizing each other as knowledgeable. This kind of environment can cause students to develop feelings of inadequacy, or perhaps even disinterest in problem solving, since the teacher is norming them to feel that someone else will always have a solution. Teaching with the lens of development is also the core of existential awareness. I have come to understand existentialism as the thought processes we follow toward becoming our best selves. When we, as teachers, live our own lives with care and consideration, we are being our best selves. But we can only do so if we are educated. Without the tools to think critically about our personal motivations, or perhaps those of others, we are merely living and not living with purpose. I do realize the question, "Can I live?" is not about someone's existential thinking, but for me this week, that question has taken on new meaning. Of course, this question is asked by people who feel that others are asking too much of them. Without someone else, like a teacher with certain expectations, being aware of your existential development, the question, "Can I live?" becomes necessary. The question, though asked in a playful manner, took on further meaning for me this week in light of considering human development in my teaching practice. Our discussions in class this week have shown me that it is difficult for students to become people and not just cogs in the school machine when they are not treated as such. My facilitation this week focused on how we could bring Vandenberg's thoughts to life in our respective classrooms. While everyone had great and specific examples of when they could become more aware of the humanity of students, the underlying theme in everyone's responses were to structure content learning around skill building. I have to wholly agree with this approach. We are nothing in the real world aside from our skills. These skills include both work readiness, but also social skills, problem-solving skills, and the skill to know oneself well enough to know which situations they will thrive in, which they should try harder in, and which they should altogether change. Thinking about skills students should learn in our classes that have nothing to do with content is sometimes a strange thing to think about when much of teaching residency thinks about how best to teach content. It is helpful that there are so many educational philosophies to choose from, and once chosen, remain changeable and adaptable to individual classes and students. It really brings to light the idea that considering what students are learning outside of content is not such a weird thing at all. Freire says this kind of awareness is a humanist approach. Quote, "From the outset, the teacher's efforts must coincide with those of the students to engage in critical thinking and the quest for mutual humanization," page 75, end quote. His dichotomy of problem posing and banking educations, in my opinion, is not a dichotomy at all. Our class discussions of Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed have led me to believe that both types of educations outlined are equally appropriate, based on what students need from you, as influenced by what is being learned, and perhaps where they are in their development as people. A problem-posing education is my favorite kind to participate in. It is, quote, "involving a constant unveiling of reality," page 81, end quote. But I do see how a banking education can allow some students to identify what information is part of reality and what information needs to be reconsidered. A personal example of when banking education worked for me. Oh boy, I didn't read this entire thing through. I hope I don't say anything embarrassing right now. I'm not even continuing to read. I'm just having this reaction. No, let's continue to pause here because Freire, at least as I reread this a few years ago, is kind of like saying banking education is the problem with education. And so here I am saying, but I do see how banking education can allow some students to identify what information is part of reality and what information needs to be reconsidered. A personal example of when banking education worked for me was when I finally learned in second or third grade that there were organs with specific functions in our bodies. I do not think that there could have been any way for me to learn that at that age without emotionally scarring me for life. But I do feel that I needed to learn. But I do feel that I needed to learn that to aid my development out of the magical thinking children have and into the critical thinker I've become today. Okay. I see what I'm saying, right? Like somebody had to tell me, right? Banking education, the teacher tells you everything. A second or third grade teacher had to tell me, like, you have a liver, you have a stomach, you have intestines. And there's no way that I would have figured that out. I mean, could I have? Like, could I have learned, like, the parts of a plant and, like, the parts of some animal and then been told, like, we're not that different? I don't know. Hindsight, always 2020. Continuing, all of the discussions about development made me wonder about my own development and learning. Much of my education was done in banking style, where the teacher knows all of the information worth knowing, and some students know it too, but perhaps because they are just smarter than I was. Problem solved as a means to learn about new information did not seem like real or relevant problems. However, I found ways to make that system work for me. And in many ways, having joined it myself years later, I'm helping to revolutionize it. Sometimes I do feel like when I was in school, things were easier because teachers just told you what to do. Whatever you did was never too far out of your comfort zone. And if you wanted to work alone on a project better done in a group, there were usually no arguments about it. Education now is very different than it was when I was in school. It makes me wonder where it will go in another 5 to 10 years, and if that new direction will be better than what we think is the best right now, and if it does change, who will have a say in those edits? I'm going to take a break here and get something to drink, but this was written by a very different self, a self with a very small fraction of the experience that I have now, and I'm astounded at the insight that that reflection, it was a class assignment, right? I'm astounded by the insight that that reflection has that I still own and that I still operate from nearly 10, if not more, years later. I'll be right back. Okay, I'm back. And I have a brand new drink. And I need to drink some because I ran out of water. I'm drinking Gingerade out of a cute little metal straw. I used to like talk so much crap about metal straws. I do enjoy them. I have never thrown any of them out. But, you know, the problem with plastic straws is that they're ending up in turtles' noses. And, like, where do you think a metal straw is going to go when you're done using it? And I suppose the concept is that you'll never be done using a metal straw, but I find that really scary. Because, like, is that suggesting that the metal straw will outlive me? Because, like, who's going to carry on my legacy? This metal straw? Like, am I having an existential crisis about a metal straw? Maybe. It's just like weird times we're living in. Okay, so last week I was gifted the opportunity to work with a group of teachers on a number of things. Among them, adjusting our classroom environments for who students really are. And I am the number one proponent of there are 40 minutes in class, there's a state test in the end. My curriculum is 14 units long, quite literally, and we gotta do what we gotta do. You don't like doing that? You could see a way out. There's a door. I literally say there's the door 3 or 4 times per week. There's only 5 days in the week. I'm saying that very often. And that's not to be, like, crazy. Crazy is an ableist term, but that's not to be, like, unreasonable. That's just to be really frank. But the idea that Freire is talking about in Pedagogy of the Oppressed, the idea that I'm reflecting on 10 years ago, is to say that the classroom is not just my place as the teacher. There are 30 to 40 other people in there for whom that classroom must shift. And it is up to me as a professional, right? I'm nobody's parent. I'm nobody's auntie. I'm nobody's sister. I am all those things. I'm really not anybody's parent. But in that classroom, I'm the professional. I'm the person with the experience to make the appropriate choices to make this whole thing go the way it's supposed to go, which is to take that state test in the end, which is to finish this 14-unit curriculum. All of that is changing, by the way. That's a whole other episode. Goodbye, 14-unit curriculum. Smell you later. but the idea is that with phenomenology, it's to make the in-class experience powerful for all students and at the same time keep the work of doing our job sustainable. And so that's when you start to ask questions about specific students or about specific classroom environments, like, what are these students bringing to the situation? And what in the legacy of schooling or in the legacy of your classroom or in the history of your teaching career, like, what part of that is a barrier to that student? And then reimagining from there. And, like, the part where you say that, like, some part of the system that exists is a barrier to this person's success later in life, living their best life, right? That can feel rough, right? I'm going to say that part out loud. That can feel like everything is my fault as the only adult in that room. I must be so horrible, you know, pity upon them who must endure me. But actually, like, it could go differently, right? You could ask all those parts that are, like, being so harsh to step aside. And as the professional, right, like, that's a part of yourself, too. The professional part steps up and says no, right? They, like, pluck their suspenders or tip their hat or, you know, button their blazer standing up. No, like, these are things that need to change, and it's my work to change them. And even if it's not permanent, it will make a difference right now. So we worked through this one example of, like, a made-up person in school, and we focused our ideas, our thinking on, like, you know, what skills or abilities or insights or approaches does this person bring into the situation? And also, what in-class or structural barriers are on the path, like, preventing this person's success? And further, like, what social barriers are on the path to their success, either hindering or helping? And then how can we reimagine a small part of the classroom experience so that those barriers are less prominent or removed altogether. And so I'm not going to like read this whole like case study, but you know, it describes someone that like, even when you were a kid, like if you're not a teacher listening to this, like, you know, this person, right? Like, and if you are a teacher, you know this person 1,000 times over, which is that like, they're the person who knows everything about everyone. They are the beating heart and soul of your individual class or your individual place of work, or like, you know, they know everything about everyone and everybody trusts them, and they can always be counted on to like have the information that like maybe saves someone's life or helps you through that problem that you're in. But, you know, in the classroom environment, this person basically gets like a D because they're very busy doing that, making connections to other people and like talking and like being social rather than like sitting quietly and doing all of their work. And maybe even, you know, this person thinks it's like kind of silly that we have to sit quietly and do work anywhere, right? Like maybe they go off to a job and they find issue with that there. Maybe it's just like in school, but like they figure it out like in life, figure it out there in their life. But a lot of the time this person gets like demonized, like, oh, they just like take all the attention, you know, in the whole place. No one can pay attention to anything else besides them. Okay. All this to say, clearly, this person I was just having a memory, sorry. Clearly, this person, I was a person like this. It's why I have a podcast. You don't make a podcast because you prefer to sit quietly and do work. Yeah. A lot of like my early report cards, you know, they were handwritten back then. A lot of them used to say this like phrase, like, what was it? Like, not talks in class, but like something to that effect. Oh, I like I can see it and like I can't. Like I can see it in my mind. Essentially, like, I've talked about this before, like wondering like do little boys get this comment about like talking too much on their report card when they're young? And then like, what does it all mean? Like, does it mean that like little boys are allowed to talk and little girls are not? And like, what if you don't identify as either, but like it's your teacher is like writing on this report card that you're talking too much, like as if that were something so essential to the classroom experience. But it is, right? Like if you're somebody who talks a lot, who requires the attention of people that you're around every single day, then it is part of your development into your best self that you have that attention and that it is positive attention. And why are classes structured such that you can't have that attention if that's the person that you're growing up to be, right? Like that's the person I was growing up to be. And it still takes quite a lot of energy to remember that, wait, like, no, I'm that person. And it's actually perfectly perfect to be that person, right? It's a lot of like layers that I've had to throw off of like, oh, you're supposed to be like this and you're supposed to be like that and you're supposed to be this and you're supposed, no, I'm not. I'm supposed to be my entire self. And that's what I was writing about in that reflection. I've since put it somewhere else. I can't like quote it back to you again. But what was interesting to me is that like, you know, the Freire book is a very old book. And this reflection that I read in the earlier piece of this is 10 years old. And it's all still not just relevant, it's all still completely important that the classroom be a space that is open to people being who they are. And I think too often it's easier to say and to think and to feel as the only adult. You're outnumbered. You're the only adult in that room. You're not at fault for feeling the way that you feel. I feel that way all the entire time. All the entire time. I'm like, it sucks to be the adult. There's only one of me. Like, why can't I be a kid too? That's exactly how I sound too in my mind. Like, uncertain of why it is that I've ended up in this situation where I am the only person who can see reason, regardless. Regardless, I think when you hear about this, like, talks too much student, and like, you don't have to identify with them. I just so happen to identify with them. There are plenty of other case studies where I don't identify with what's going on, right? But when you hear about a student who is good at something, thinking about like how your classroom is promoting their like humanization, how they become a thoughtful and caring person in the world. And like, it's a whole other episode to talk about how nobody is a thoughtful and caring person anymore. But to expand a person's reality, to consider like, it's okay that you talk a lot in class. Actually, here's what you could be doing when you're talking this much in class. Like, it's not about, you know, how do you get that kid to give you some of their power? It's more about how do you share that power, right? Like, it can't just be one person all the time. Even when you go to work, your boss isn't there all the time. Sure, like, they would like for you to think that they're watching your every move, but they're not. They're a person, too, who's, like, just trying to get through the day as well. Does that mean you should, like, take advantage of them? Absolutely not. Does that mean that, like, you should still be who you are because that's probably why you were hired? Yes. Right? Like, if you're going to go to the interview and be like, yeah, I can't be on time and, like, I don't care about this and I'm just trying to collect a check. Like, that's a whole other thing. And I think that is, like, something we can address later because there's a complete, like, lack of code switching in this generation. And maybe that's part of the talks a lot problem. But the talks a lot person is a timeless person, right? Talks a lot person is a person that, like, you can really damage by telling them that they're talking too much and that they have to get with your program and that, you know, sometimes it's time for me to talk, right? Like, that, all of that, as much as it's, like, gentle ways to refocus, it's damaging because it's like it's maintaining the status quo a little too much, right? It's maintaining the status quo at the expense of that person feeling okay to be who they are. And you know what? Like, not everybody has thousands of dollars of therapy to like fix that after you fuck that up for them. And, like, I've gone this far in the episode without using expletives, but, like, there's no other way to explain how you would be, like, messing up a person's thoughts of themselves by insisting, like, no, you're going to be silent now, right? If that person can agree, like, oh, wait, no, I want to know what you're about to say, that's really different. That's really different than insisting like there is only one way. And I think as a public school educator who has so many students and, you know, I'm not the only one, right? Like all of those students belong to so many teachers, right? It can be easier to just maintain. Here's the classwork. Here's the homework. Here's this. Here's that. Oh, you didn't do it. That's a zero. You know, for this, there's that. Action consequence. Right. For every action you take, you've made an agreement for what your consequence will be. A consequence is just an agreement. But as a professional, professionals are hired to revolutionize, not maintain. And maybe I have an outsized sense of self. All right, what am I doing in any of the spaces that I am in? Maybe I'm really only hired in existence to maintain. But that's not enough for me. That's not to say like you're not a professional if you don't revolutionize. Like you're very much a professional if you don't revolutionize. But if you know the origin of education is people clutching their pearls because they see pictures of people who are poorer than them suffering downtown. Right here downtown. Those streets were not even paved. There was not even plumbing. A lot of the apartment buildings probably still are up there with a shared bathroom in the hallway, if that. You ever like seen an apartment on like wherever, like Street Easy, whatever, and like the whole like shower, toilet, sink is directly next to the kitchen, and like they write in the description like quaint, studio apartment. And there's no fucking door or wall between the toilet and your stove. Like, this is how the other half lived. And it was more than half. And it was horrible. And it remains horrible. But what happened as a result of people seeing for the first time, like, oh, wait. There's a whole culture of people just trying to live, not maintain, not revolutionize. They can't even live. There's not enough air in their apartment. How the Other Half Lives changed my entire life. I read it before I even thought about being a teacher. I wish I had like seen the pictures, like maybe I have to get to the library. Yeah, bring back the library. Give me a reason to get to the library. Yes, I need to find that book in the library to see the actual pictures. I'm sure I'll be horrified too. I will wear my pearls just to clutch them. But the rant that I was on just now was to say education, the way it exists, especially in New York and definitely in this whole country, was made as a reaction to rich people seeing how other people were living and how different it was from them. And so rich people don't know any better. I'm sure they knew plenty. You know, it was only they who could go to college. But not knowing any better, they say amongst each other, like, oh, like, what do we do for these poor, wretched folk? You know, like, let's make them job ready. And what was a job back then? There used to be factories upstate. There used to be factories in the country. There used to be factories everywhere. Build a car, make a mitten, make a coat, like make a shirt. You know, everything that we needed was being made somewhere. Ooh, who is we? Rich people. Poor people had to make their own. Interesting. Anyway. So, you know, these rich people make all these choices. And what are these choices? These choices are that poor people need to learn about hygiene. And poor people need to learn about how to be in one place and then the next and then the next and then the next at the ring of a bell. And they learn that you gotta be somewhere dumb early in the morning, even though you are developmentally ill prepared to be anywhere at that time of the morning. And they also decide that if people decide not to submit to this system, that they should face really dangerous conditions to go get a job anyway without an education, right? The point of the education for rich people prescribing it to poor people was to go get a job. But the real purpose of education is to know who you are, so that when you are making a choice about what to do with the rest of your life, you're making a really informed choice and a better decision overall. We should have an episode about how to make a better decision. I've got a lot of ideas that are not being taught in school. And when I mention them in my classroom, it's like, what are we doing? Not learning chemistry. What's wrong with you? These are my revolution. Making space to teach the things that nobody is teaching you. Maybe it's uncomfortable. And it is uncomfortable to tell a fellow educator that talkative person is not your enemy. That talkative person doesn't even have to be your friend. But you need to make space for that talkative person. That is so uncomfortable because that's not something any of us were ever taught directly. And in fact, we were probably taught like, oh, somebody was talking in your class, you fail as an educator. And I'm not going to like get up on a pedestal right now and be like, it's so hard to believe 10 years later, after this reflection that I made in school, that educators are still doing this. It's hard. Every day, the choices that you make are hard choices to make. But you became educated and you became the educator to effect change. Some people have it real different. Some people don't want to affect change. Some people are happy with the way things are. And maybe there's a lot to be happy about. But as a science teacher in this day and age, where it's almost devalued to do any real science, to make any choices of your own, to make mistakes and learn from them, in a world where none of that is happening, and like out there in the real world, all of that is happening. But to be in a space where none of that is happening and none of that is like even allowed to happen makes me want to just like, you know, take a little hammer to the system. Not a little hammer either. A big hammer, I'll hammer it a little bit. I won't break the whole thing, I swear. Without revolution, nothing can change for the better, right? I keep saying this, like, there's all this, like, new technology, like, take a picture wearing these sunglasses and, you know, whatever else. Remember when, like, AirPods were crazy? Like, what do you mean there's no wire? Or, like, charging your phone by, like, placing it somewhere. What do you mean I don't have to plug it? You do have to plug it in, actually. But my point is, if you still have to plug it in, it's old technology. Right? So how do we ever get past plugging it in if we're just happy with plugging it in?